Welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight we present the last in our series of programs containing excerpts taken from the conference on Our Country, Our Culture, held this past spring at Boston University and sponsored by the Partisan Review. Tonight's program finds participants speaking on America and Europe, Who Leads? We will hear excerpts from three speakers. First, David Price Jones, senior editor of National Review and author of Closed Circle and The War That Never Was, about the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Second, Professor Leah Greenfeld, university professor and an expert on nationalism, who will speak on the parochialism of globalization. And third, Connor Cruz O'Brien, Irish diplomat and author. Here now is David Price Jones.
Time has to pass before contemporaries perceive the meaning of events which they are themselves living. It was not until the 1830s and the generation of de Tocqueville that the French began to come to terms with the 1789 revolution. Only after a similar span of 40 years could the Soviet terror and the Holocaust be seen as the crimes against mankind that they were. It is still too soon to assess the full significance of the fall of communism in the Soviet Union and its empire. But on the side of the victors in the late and unlamented Cold War, something unexpected is already happening. The outline of a historic shift is appearing. The United States and its major Cold War allies are no longer forming a bloc of like-minded democracies, but going their separate ways. During the decades of the Cold War, the democracies of Western Europe sheltered under the wing of the United States. Communist parties were poised to take power in France and Italy, and later in Portugal, and might have done so without American tutelage and the American-led organizations of mutual defense devised to bring political and military cohesion to the European democracies. It was a success story. I say it's cold in here, my nose is running. I'm so sorry. The price to be paid for it was the Americanization of Western Europe. This was a repeat of previous imperial processes. The Romans had built roads and theaters and garrisons to civilize peoples they thought barbarian. The British had set up parliaments and law courts for those they considered natives, and of course clubs and race courses for themselves. Now came the Americans, their ambassadors as powerful as satraps, their military manning bases and harbors, introducing a vernacular language and a culture comprising food and clothes and popular music, quite different and more informal manners. They had their ways of doing business, in private and public. It is reasonable to assert that the large majority of Europeans welcomed this epic development, taking it as evidence of liberation and not colonialism. I remember in post-war Italy that children my age went barefoot, and that in post-war France, I saw women washing linen in the farmyard stream, while the men were driving Percheron cart horses to drink in that water. Now their descendants dressed like Americans, in jeans and baseball caps worn back to front. Out have gone blueberries, and the Percherons have given way to Massey Ferguson tractors. National costume is a thing of the past. In has come fast food, the household gadgetry of television sets and washing machines, and of course the equality of the sexes and the changes in family life and relationships that necessarily accompany the gadgetry. W.H. Auden, a cosmopolitan spirit, wrote a poem to celebrate the installation of an American kitchen in his house in provincial Austria. At this level, almost everyone welcomes Americanization, as once the Germanic tribes gladly shed animal skins in favor of togas, or citizens of the British Empire abandoned native clothes in favor of trousers and jackets, and took to eating sticky puddings as well. European elites, though, are a different matter. In ruling circles in Europe, democracy is a concession to the great unwashed, not a good in itself, the worst of systems except for all other systems, in Churchill's abiding words. To them, elections are best treated not as an appeal for the consent of the governed, but as a form of musical chairs in a privileged circle. The outstanding example is Italy, where there have been over 50 changes of government, but the offices have been shared out among 300 ministers. Hilton Kramer asked me to mention how the Italians have solved the cultural problem. They award prizes for everyone. There are over 3,000 literary prizes in Italy alone. So if you meet a novelist, he's likely to have several hundred literary prizes to his biography. The accommodating French system allows for cohabitation, an arrangement which principally is a division of the spoils. In Germany, coalition politics keep the same handful of people in office for years. Taking their intellectual and political supremacy for granted, European elites have long been accustomed to setting the standards in taste and culture as well. For them, Americanization has been a challenge to their autonomy. Morally discredited by the wartime German occupation of the continent from Brest to the Caucasus, military enfeebled, bewildered by the rapidity and profundity of change, petrified by the hostility of the Soviet Union and the Iron Curtain dividing the continent, they were in no position to resist Americanization. They could only go in for delaying or blocking tactics, for Ozymandias's wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command. Talk began to be heard about the Europeans and the role of civilized and sophisticated Greeks to the crudely simple American Romans. The British way of life, the German Sonderweg, the Exception Française, the Via Italiana, acquired nostalgia, that powerful stranglehold on the emotion. France has replaced the defunct Soviet Union as the main source of anti-Americanism in the world, more dramatic in its scope and consequences even than Islamism, the competing source of anti-Americanism. A mixture of rational and irrational motives are in play, as first embodied by General de Gaulle and then thriving as his legacy. From his relationship with President Roosevelt during the last war, he retained suspicions that the United States viewed France as a great power well past its prime, and he never forgot or forgave what he took to be the slight to national honor. Hitler's Germany destroyed France's former status as a power, but the blame for this had to be shifted onto the United States as France came to terms with post-war Germany. Displacing the old imperial powers of Britain and France, the United States indeed made mistakes which could be easily exploited. For instance, over the 1956 Suez Crisis, or in Southeast Asia, once the source of French colonial pride. By 1963, de Gaulle was saying to Alain Perfit, one of his ministers, and a most faithful echo, I quote, "The truth is that the Americans will end up getting themselves hated by the whole world." De Gaulle's successors, whether nominally on the left or the right, have done what they could to make that prediction come true. US Go Home was the popular slogan at the foundation of this mindset. Political anti-Americanism among the French is nowadays expressed in slightly more sophisticated but essentially similar terms. For instance, condemning the United States as a hyperpuissance, hyperpower, or unilateralist, or unipolar, or simplistic, all pejorative adjectives to cover the pursuit of its own interests. Envy of the American presence and power motivates the spiting of American powers globally. For instance, in large matters, such as the departure of France from NATO, or its backing of the Arabs against Israel, and its defense of Iraq, down to small incidents, such as a French officer leaking NATO plans to Serbia at the time of the Kosovo campaign. The adversarial climate of opinion has long been set firm. The United States has a navigation satellite system which it offers to share freely. But President Chirac warns that without such a system of its own, Europe will have, I quote, vassal status to the United States. Asked by an interviewer, why does the image of France as anti-American persist? Former Prime Minister Lionel Jospin replied in the best Delphic style, there is confusion. Jean-Pierre Chevènement, a presidential candidate, holds that the United States is aiming at the, quote, cretinization of France. No chance is lost to generalize unfavorably about the uncouthness of Americans and their presidents in particular, to denigrate American presidents as cowboys or worse, and to generalize unfavorably about Americans as obese, ignorant rednecks, and whatever. In a typical sneer, Jospin went so far as to say that President Bush's election will always be in doubt, in quotes. One of the pleasures of life used to be a visit to a French bookshop. Within living memory, new works were to be found by writers such as Mauriac, Malraux, Sartre and Camus, Anouilh, René Char, Ionesco, Raymond Aron, many other household names. The cultural arm of the French government has lately sent me the modern fiction it recommends, listing novels by Jean-Jacques Schul, Jean Tellier, Anne Bragance, Tonino Benacquista, Franz Bartelt, Brigitte Giraud, Jean de Bernard, and others, all of whom may be estimable, but none have reached beyond the Boulevard Saint-Germain. Incidentally, slightly over two-thirds of the books published in Germany are translations from the English, and the disproportion is only slightly less in Italy. Stacked up in French bookshops are anti-American tracts. Panic about American cultural hegemony, a word I hate to use, but there you are, goes back to the early 20th century, perhaps to the German writer Paul Dane's essay with the title The Americanization of the World. Such a panic was then rare in France. Even so morose and murderous a character as Céline enjoyed his stay in the States between the wars. Saint-Exupéry and André Maurois praised New York. But this opinion reversed in post-war France. In large proportion, criticism of America stemmed from the Communist Party, which dictated the intellectual climate of the times. But such criticism had its right-wing, Gaullist input too. The campaign against Hollywood films is waged with real nationalist intensity in a form of protectionism, as though the French themselves were incapable of making better films by way of demonstrating cultural vitality. Alain Besançon's remark should never be forgotten, however, that 1,000 Hollywood films can never match the damage wrought by one French philosopher on campus. Jean-Marie Messier is chairman of Vivendi Universal, originally a water and sewage business, which he and others have been transforming into a global media and filmmaking group with headquarters in New York. At the end of last year, he said, the Franco-French cultural exception is dead. The language may have been stilted, but the ensuing affair was heartfelt and lasts to this day. He's accused of spitting in the face of French politicians and cinema professionals. In defense of cultural exceptionality, President Chirac pontificated, to consider works of art and cultural goods as ordinary merchandise is a profound mental aberration. Hubert Védrine, the foreign minister, and a man who seizes every opening for anti-Americanism, has said that the French cannot accept a, quote, culturally uniform world. The campaign against McDonald's has already found a violent outlet for such unqualified nationalism. So in the bookshops now are works like Who is Killing France? No guesses for the answer. American Totalitarianism, No Thanks, Uncle Sam, A Strange Dictatorship, and many others in that vein. To a question asking, who are the principal enemies of France in the world? Just under one-third replied, the USA, in a poll published in the Figaro of April the 2nd. Another poll, conducted a little earlier by the Pew Research Center, found that 73% of the Germans involved thought that President Bush made decisions based entirely on US interests. 74% of the Italians thought likewise, 79% of the British, rising to 85% of the French. Continental Europeans have had to discover that the English language is a sine qua non of modernity. A row erupted in Holland over a decision to teach university classes in English. But all over continental Europe, scientific and technical work is carried out and published in English. The French language has lost its international cachet. Algeria and Vietnam are among former colonies which have jettisoned the teaching of French from the national school syllabus. A government-sponsored body exists to promote French under the patronage of President Chirac, but even scraping the barrel to include Poles and other foreigners, there are hardly more than 100 million French speakers today, humiliatingly many times fewer than speakers of Arabic and even Spanish. If England is allowed to claim as its own writers, like V.S. Naipaul and Salman Rushdie, then something of its literary traditions survives. A search of Europe will reveal virtually no novelists or poets capable of transcending provincialism in order to make the appeal, the universal appeal, which was once the glory of its several literatures. The same is true for composers, architects, historians, and painters and filmmakers. The arts as a whole in Europe are reduced to transgression, a phrase we've heard already today. It's a little transitory and usually confessional episodes designed not to illuminate the human condition, but to upset and shock anyone rash enough to come within reach. Ultimately, these are manifestations of distress and self-hate from which nothing is to be learned. The same phenomenon is to be observed in the United States, of course. It may be, as we said this morning, that de Tocqueville's pessimism about the inevitable decline of the arts in a democracy is being borne out before our eyes. But I believe that something more profound is taking place. Years of brutalism, structuralism and deconstruction, existentialism, relativism, the nouveau roman, the theater of the absurd, Foucault and Lacan, the Red Brigade and the Baader-Meinhof gang and the IRA, Eurocommunism, functionalism, postmodernism, neo-fascism, and all the other isms and their promoters, testify not to vitality, but to loss of direction and the general inversion of moral values, the supremacy of unexamined emotion, in a word, degeneracy. The political and cultural elites of Europe, it seems to me, are playing to these feelings. Internalizing them, they seek to defend themselves, first, by projecting a hostile stereotype of people whom they know are more energetic and successful than themselves. So they think of Americans as self-appointed to be God's chosen people, undeservedly privileged, indecently rich, retrograde in the certainty of their traditional morality. Americans have the death penalty. They bomb all over the globe from Iraq to Serbia. They support Israel. They refuse to sign up to do-gooding treaties that will save the world's environment or bring dictators before an international court. They pretend to be in favor of free trade but impose economic sanctions when it suits them, and they pursue those who come to kill them. The Guardian newspaper, a repository of such stereotyping, spoke for the opinion-making left throughout Europe when it recently declared that President Reagan's phrase, "the empire of evil," now describes the United States. On another occasion, that the United States is, quote, an unrepentant outlaw. This attitudinizing seeps down from the top to the mob on the street, traveling around cities to break up summit meetings in the name of anti-globalism, itself an inventive slogan for anti-Americanism. Although himself a natural grazer in the bilious pastures of the Guardian, Salman Rushdie is a rare example of an intellectual willing to backpedal. This spring, he wrote, "Anyone who has visited Britain and Europe or followed the public conversation there during the past 5 months would have been struck, even shocked, by the depth of anti-American feeling among large segments of the population. Western anti-Americanism is an altogether more petulant phenomenon than its Islamic counterpart, and far more personalized. In the non-American West, the main objection seems to be to American people." The European elites have also found the means of externalizing their feelings. The European Union originated in an ideal, namely that the way to avoid war between France and Germany was to bind them together through mutual interests. From little acorns, great oaks do grow. 50 years of development have enlarged the underlying ideal into something unrecognizable, and not by design, but by accident, as occasion arose. There was no equivalent to the founding fathers in Philadelphia, weighing up a constitution with a general good borne in mind. Instead, ad hoc arrangements, one step at a time, have produced a centralized capital in Brussels, where there are no clear distinctions between the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary, no democratic checks and balances, but only a formidable machinery, a command bureaucracy of which the Soviet Union would have been proud, for passing orders and decrees which are binding and without appeal, to regulate aspects of daily life down to the most trivial, of which hitherto government has taken no notice. Unaccountable and unstoppable, the machinery cranks its way forward like a Frankenstein monster. Over 80,000 orders and decrees have already trussed up the continent, affecting public and private relations in an unprecedented manner. This arising empire has already pushed aside 15 historic states, draining them of their independence and identity, redefining their concepts of liberty and citizenship. It is due to enlarge its number and its scope. All sorts of ideas for an overall constitution, for federation and further centralized powers are under discussion. Trying to establish an identity of its own, the Brussels command bureaucracy devotes ingenuity to promoting a concept of European culture, which in plain fact turns out to be an artificiality, limited to football matches and the Eurovision Song Contest. To the experienced Henry Kissinger, this evolution of Europe is, quote, one of the most revolutionary events of our time. The EU already has a police force with extraterritorial powers, and perhaps within 2 years it will have a military force of its own. Advocates of the EU enthusiastically anticipate the coming projection of European power. The eventual counterbalance of the two continents, as they foresee, will allow Europe to put an end to American hyperpuissance, unipolarity, and unilateralism. The extent to which continental Europe is already opposing American interests is clear. For instance, resisting any wider war against terror, seeking to appease Iraq and Iran and North Korea, condemning the proposal for a missile shield, and proposing an international court where the accused are sure to consist largely of American politicians and military. The EU's dismantling of the nation state with its democratic safeguards is already provoking the expected nationalist backlash. Jean-Marie Le Pen, Silvio Berlusconi, Jörg Haider, the unfortunate Pim Fortuyn in Holland, and who knows what persuasive populists lurk over the horizon, engendering the very uncertainty and maybe violence that the whole experiment is designed to eliminate. That is a grim enough prospect, but there is worse. Erecting another system of rule, not based on the freely given consent of the people, the EU is institutionalizing the continent's moral, cultural, and political failure in the age of the dictators, and it is deliberately defining itself against the United States. It may still take some time to perceive it, but the fragmentation of the democratic world is as consequential as the breakup of the Roman Empire once was. Thank you.
National Review Senior Editor David Price Jones. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. You're listening to excerpts from the conference on Our Country, Our Culture, 1952 to 2002, sponsored by the Partisan Review. Tonight's topic is America and Europe, Who Leads? Our next speaker, University Professor Leah Greenfeld, is the author of Nationalism, Five Roots to Modernity. Professor Greenfeld spoke on the parochialism of globalization. Here now are excerpts from her remarks.
Because the conference is titled Our Country and Our Culture and deals with American intellectuals, I have to discuss the subject of this panel, Europe and the U.S., who leads, specifically in the application to intellectuals. That is, whether it is the American or the European intellectuals that lead. If my assumption was correct, there must be two assumptions behind this panel. First, the assumption of the uniformity of relationships between any two communities. If one is dominant economically, it must be dominant culturally. If one is dominant in any area of culture, for instance in science, it must be also dominant in literature and in music. This is a very wrong assumption. So the fact that the United States culturally has been the periphery of Europe in the 19th century, certainly, and since then has emerged into self-sufficiency, does not at all imply that Europe would become a periphery of the United States. The intellectual role thus devolved on science. Most of the practicing scientists, physicists and biologists, could not care less about that. Their curiosity led them in a different direction, at the same time making life so interesting that they were perhaps the least bothered by the conflicting pressures of modern society among all its denizens. But the literati seized on the opportunity, and calling themselves scientists, social scientists that is, claimed the authority of the intellectual role for themselves. As there were no other claimants, writers of fiction dabbling in the articulation of American culture on the individual and, so to speak, voluntaristic basis, without the support of numbers and without a formal title, social scientists were granted this authority and became the intellectuals designate of the United States. Writers, therefore, were pushed out. No longer would sensitive people perplexed, bothered, or curious about the workings of society attempt to understand it through fiction. They would carry their perplexities to the departments of economics, history, political science, and sociology in the universities. I am, of course, here depicting a trend. It did not happen overnight. But in the long run, I would say, in quite the first half of the 20th century, modern novel, as defined by Wharton, practically disappeared, and literature from a serious intellectual preoccupation on the part of both the author and the reader, a powerful analytical and educational tool, a form of social philosophy, transformed into a sort of entertainment for the highbrows, a form of aesthetic, or probably more often, psychological self-indulgence. No wonder that Professor Pinsker cannot find now a book that would be recognized by all his undergraduates. There are no books that are relevant for them. They have to look, unfortunately, to Nirvana to find articulation of their cultural experience. But while they assumed the title of intellectuals, social scientists were unprepared at first and made it virtually impossible as time went by to fulfill the responsibility of intellectuals. Thus, the American nation, which of all nations needs intellectuals most, while accommodating its literati, was left without intellectuals. This makes the point whether they lead European intellectuals or European intellectuals lead them rather mute. To begin with, social scientists lacked the intellectual orientation. They were not curious about society and were not interested in understanding it. They defined themselves and became social scientists because of the status this implied, their chief interest being to strengthen and safeguard this status. Indeed, the first order of business for the nascent American historians, economists, political scientists, and sociologists who busily branched off each other around the turn of the 20th century was to form their professional associations, though the examples of physics and biology suggested that science could be practiced quite successfully and for many years without such trade unions. It was also social scientists who provided the leadership in the formation of the American Association of University Professors. And while physicists and biologists were occupied in their research, made sure that the life of the mind in America would have the security of academic tenure. They focused on the rights of the newly acquired position. Intellectual responsibilities were the least of their concerns. Still, as they identified as social scientists, they had to give some thought to what social science might be. The image of science was any layman's idea of physics and biology. And so they concluded that it was the application to social questions of the characteristic procedures of physics and biology, namely observation, literally looking at, as a physicist or biologist might do, of material phenomena which could be seen, touched, counted, and measured, and formulation of statements, if at all possible, using mathematical equations and numbers, and if not, at least using esoteric terminology and highly abstract, which, for the reason of their mathematical appearance and abstract character, could be called scientific laws. They did not take the trouble to consider the possibility that procedures of physics and biology, which were not necessarily the same for physics and biology, may not be applicable to the study of social reality, which was different from the realities studied by physics and biology. Social reality was defined in the way which made them applicable, a convenient definition which left out virtually everything that distinguished humanity from animals. And in any case, social scientists, by and large, were not interested in the study of social reality. They used their authority as scientists to vent their grievances against the worthless society which so obviously lacked judgment as to allow base businessmen to get socially ahead of lofty characters such as themselves, and enabled by the bounty of these very businessmen to pass from anxiety to academy, to use Professor Diggins's suggestive title, denounced this society from the sanctuary of their professorships, exposing these businessmen in particular for what they truly were, the bloodsuckers of the human race. Thus, remarkably, they combined a formalistic scientism, obsessive preoccupation with the appearances of science, with a most unabashed ideological preaching in total disregard of the scientific ethos. The only area in the social sciences in which, during the century of their institutionalized existence, one can see any cumulative development is methodology, that is, theory about how to practice social science, which from the start emerged as a central area of specialization independent of any substantive concerns. In all other respects, despite the characteristic fetishness and cliquishness of the so-called social scientific community, there is most astonishing lack of change. And after 100 years of pampering, the attitude of American literati towards their society remains as unforgiving as before. In the course of these 100 years, there have been, of course, many innocent people, uncommitted ideologically, and sincerely interested in the study of society, who were drawn to the social science departments, totally unaware of what they were about to step into. Inevitably, the great majority of them were disabled by their professional training. The nauseating mixture of ideology and methodology was fed to them as their discipline. Realistically, the only alternative they had to digesting it was throwing the social science up in disgust. But how many have the courage to do so after years of graduate school? To be an intellectual under the circumstances of anomic, perplexing, fluid American society requires an acute intelligence, a powerful imagination, and an ability to disregard inherited wisdom. What distinguishes the human brain from computers, besides its three dimensions on which Mr. Kurzweil focused yesterday, is the ability to resist the flow of information from the outside at will and to generate information inside. This is what we call imagination or creativity. Rats are much better learners in the specific sense of the word, that is, internalizing information from the outside, than human beings, and for this reason, much closer to computers than we are. It is important to remember that great creative geniuses, such as Einstein or Michael Faraday in science, Balzac, Dostoevsky, and Dickens in literature, were quite indifferent students. But when inherited wisdom, a set of learned maxims, defines one's identity as a sociologist, historian, or economist, and one's social position, one is likely to have a vested interest in it and be unable to unlearn what one is taught. I once suggested to Eric Kandel, whose Nobel Prize Dr. Weizmann showed us yesterday, apropos social science and neuroscience, that the trouble with social scientists was that they have acquired a place on the campus without first going through the trouble of developing a hippocampus. The comforts of the academy had rather deleterious effects on American would-be intellectuals, since for 100 years they compete only among themselves. The acquisition of general education, or culture as it was called in the olden days, became unnecessary for them. The universities, therefore, have made American literati literally illiterate. An American historian can go through life knowing no European history. An historian of the Russian Revolution never having read Tocqueville's Old Regime. Sociologists and political scientists consider knowing history a disciplinary offense. And economists seem to doubt whether there is such a thing as history at all, and certainly do not know what it is good for, unless it be to offer a living to economic historians. The knowledge of languages is rare, even among those who do what they call comparative work. I personally know senior people in these professions, in the most important universities in the land, who do not read books only articles in professional journals as a matter of principle. And this is the group to which America leaves the interpretation and articulation of its culture. The perspective of the social sciences, limited from the outset by their careerist preoccupations and the nature of their chosen identity, is necessarily becoming more limited as the level of general literacy among them drops lower. Indeed, they must resort to sympathetic fallacy, of which David Landis accuses economists and economic historians. That is, taking what they know for what there is. They know extremely little, and so they must imagine social reality as very simple. This explains the ludicrous idea of homo economicus, whose behavior, individual and collective, can be exhaustively described by mathematical formulas, and the predominance of unilinear historicist theories, essentially based on this idea. These theories, which ultimately derive from Marx's historical materialism / economic determinism, are also fortunately and not unexpectedly entirely consistent with German romantic misinterpretation of Adam Smith, and so are believed to accord with classical economics, whose scientific status cannot be doubted because it cannot be doubted ever. Thus, with one violent blow, they take care both of the scientific and of the ideological cravings of their proponents. I use the plural theories, but actually there has been only one theory under several names. Today we know it under the name of globalization. But it was known and abandoned for the lack of evidence as theory of modernization or convergence or development or dependence before. And this is to use only a few of its aliases. The fundamental and fundamentally Marxist idea of this theory is that economic and beyond them technological forces drive the world towards greater and greater integration, turning it into what Marshall McLuhan already called the global village. But the trend is generally recognized as globalization only after the alleged triumph of the West in the Cold War. Now, not everyone shares all the views about globalization. Some believe that it is good, and others that it is rather sinister. And there are some disagreements as to the precise nature of the driving force. Is it communications technology or market rationality, for instance? All this is beside the point. The point is that it does not exist. Contrary to the buzz, there is no evidence of globalization. The realization that this is so would have little importance for the great majority of us if the games social scientists play had no influence. But they do. They are invested by this society with the responsibility to interpret and articulate it with intellectual authority. They educate millions of our children. They influence curricula in elementary schools. They train our journalists. Since the days of Woodrow Wilson, they have the ear of our government, and their political influence grows. It is not an exaggeration to state, as did Fortune magazine, in all earnestness, that economists rule the world. for they literally did so under the previous administration. Economists are the poster boys of the social science. Their scientific credentials are so impeccable that it is not even funny. But in fact, there is little difference between economics and its younger and equally pernicious sisters. We, as a nation, designated a group of resentful, ignorant, and self-seeking anti-Americans, America's intellectuals, and thereby placed ourselves at their mercy. They have the power to lead, and they mislead. In my view, this is the tragedy of this country.
University Professor Leah Greenfeld. I'm Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. Our final speaker tonight is Irish diplomat and author Conor Cruise O'Brien. A severe critic of extreme nationalism in his own country and elsewhere, Mr. O'Brien's remarks offer one approach to peace in the Middle East. Conor Cruise O'Brien.
When I gave this talk, the talk which follows the title you have just heard, I was thinking primarily of the Middle East and the division between Washington and the principal countries in the European continent over policy towards Israel. I was going to point out that the European policy of backing Arafat makes no sense at all, since Arafat has far less authority in Palestine than bodies like Hamas, openly committed to war with Israel and now urging such a war. I would say that recently when Arafat was under arrest, powerless and a kind of symbol of Arab powerlessness, he achieved a return of popularity. But since his recent release, his property, his popularity has again plummeted, as articles in today's newspapers amply demonstrate. I have not changed those views, but I have recently become aware of proposals which, if fully implemented, could greatly fortify Israel's position and render the position of Israel's European critics, or rather enemies, irrelevant and without power to influence events. Some of the proposals I have in mind emanate from North Lebanon, from Christian Arab sources traditionally friendly to Israel, though now engaged in a kind of marriage of convenience with the Syrian authorities. The main element in these proposals concerns Arab migrant labor working in Israel. The great majority of these migrant workers come to Israel to earn their living and have no political agenda. But they involuntarily provide a screen behind which a small minority of terrorists can penetrate Israel. The terrorists, dressing like Arab migratory laborers, can rarely be distinguished by Israeli officials from the harmless laborers among whom they move. Under that cover, they can move until they reveal their identity by ferocious suicide bombings indiscriminately against Jewish civilians and many times repeated, causing the present very great crisis. These Lebanese have suggested to the Israelis that they replace the Arab migrants with migratory labor from places like India and Sri Lanka, where the population are immune to the anti-Israel feeling powerful amongst all Arabs, including the migrants. If this can be done, and it will take some time to organize, it would eliminate terrorism from the Israeli labor market, and this would already be a very considerable achievement. This would indeed be a major contribution to Israel's security. But it would still leave Israel damagingly entangled with its Arab neighbors through the Jewish settlements on Arab territories on the West Bank. If Israel were to withdraw its own forces from the area, simply leaving the settlers there, all the settlers, deprived of Israeli protection, would simply be massacred by their Arab neighbors. There's no doubt about that. There is only one remedy. If Israel does decide to withdraw from the West Bank, the Israel Defense Forces must take their settlers along with them, if necessary, using force against them for their own protection. It may perhaps be said, and perhaps will be said, that this is an improbable scenario. Yet the thing has been done before. When Menachem Begin was engaged in peace discussions with Sadat of Egypt, the proceedings were stalled for some months by disagreement over the Jewish settlers in the Sinai Desert. Begin wanted to keep them there. Sadat said that unless Israel agreed to withdraw all the settlers from Sinai, Sadat would never sign a peace treaty with Israel. When he found that Sadat could not be budged from that position, Begin agreed to withdraw all the settlers and finally did so. The peace so achieved has lasted into our own time.
Connor Cruz O'Brien speaking at last spring's conference sponsored by the Partisan Review on Our Country, Our Culture, the Changing Role of Intellectuals, Artists, and Scientists in America, 1952 to 2002. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program was produced by Vince Fairchild with help from John Hoder. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.